and look forward to an extremely productive day. And now I get to introduce Judge Nan Waller, and Judge Maurer just stole one of my big lines, but it's worth repeating. The Judge Waller is soon to be the presiding judge for Multnomah County Circuit Court. She's currently the chief family court judge, and Judge Waller attended the University of Oregon Law School. She serves on our LIPSC Executive Committee. She has served on LIPSC's Juvenile Justice Council, and she was named 2011 National Court Appointed Special Advocates Judge of the Year. Judge Waller.
I want to start off by thanking Commissioner Shiprock and Mayor Adams for their leadership on our local public safety coordinating council. For those of you outside of the metro area, we have an incredibly robust LIPSC, and in your folders is our new brochure that describes what LIPSC does. But now more than ever, as we all face incredibly challenging times, the level of cooperation, communication, and collaboration that our LIPSC promotes is absolutely vital and necessary to the well-being of our community and of our public safety system. And I also want to thank Commissioner Shiprock for the tremendous work that she does every year in organizing what works. All of us are in the work that we do because we have passion for it. And we want to do what's right by our communities, by the people to whom we have responsibility, and for whom we have responsibility. Our current economic crisis makes it absolutely even more imperative that we get it right when we invest in people. I am especially glad that this year Commissioner Shiprock chose for the first time to focus on juvenile justice. There is an urgency when we are dealing with our children and our young people that we take the moment of opportunity that we have when we come in contact with them to do it right. We know now from some of the research that sometimes our best efforts do more harm than good, and we do not have either in terms of the moral responsibility that we have and the health of our communities that we can't do that any longer. We don't have the resources. We can't lose our young people. We have had in this community a very difficult fall and winter as we've seen tragedy after tragedy occur with our young people. So I'm very excited to be here. I'm very excited that I have an opportunity to introduce one of my role models. I first met Judge Martin when she came to Portland to help us celebrate the 100th anniversary of the creation of juvenile court in Oregon in 1994. And we brought her here because she comes from Chicago, the birthplace of juvenile court. And I knew as I listened to her talk about what children and young people need that she was somebody to watch. And I have watched her career over the years since then and have taken much from the lessons I've learned from her as she has worked for the on the bench in Chicago since 1996 as the presiding judge in the Division of Child Protection. She's been the lead judge for the National Council for their model court, which is set up to improve and try out new strategies, not to be say that they are best, but to say that they are willing and courageous enough to try out what works. And she has had remarkable success in terms of reducing the numbers of children in foster care in Cook County, reducing the caseload by looking at what do we need to do for children to keep them out of our systems? Because we all know, once in our system, sometimes it's hard to get kids out again. And so if we can prevent kids from coming in and having healthy lives, all the better, and all the better for all of us. Prior to becoming a judge, Judge Martin worked in the Public Defender's Office in Cook County. She is a member and past chair of the Supreme Court of Illinois' Judicial Conference Study Committee on Juvenile Justice, and she is now, based upon her expertise, the excellent work she has done, and the wealth of experience that she brings to the table. She is the current president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. If you don't know of the work of the National Council, I would urge you to go to their website. There is a wealth of information about what works. The National Council is really dedicated to helping judges, courts, and other players to our judicial system use the best practices, base the work that they do on what works. And she was elected this last year and is a tremendous leader around the country in terms of making sure that judges are equipped with the tools necessary so that when they have a family, a child, a youth in front of them, they will bring to the table the tools necessary to assure the best opportunity for success. We know that we can't, as judges, guarantee success for the people who come in front of us, but we also know that we have a unique opportunity to change the course of lives. And when you're dealing with children, there is an absolute urgency to trying to get it right. So with that, I'm going to introduce Judge Martin. You will love what she has to say, her enthusiasm, her passion that she brings to the table. So help me welcome Judge Martin.
Thank you so much. You're so sweet.
Well, you are so good.
I'm walking a little slow, so please bear with me. It looks worse than it is, truly. I tore a ligament in my knee, and my brother's a doctor, so of course I called him and I asked him, you know, what do I do? And he says, well, Pat, you know you're getting old. I said, so that's what your medical school education's doing for me, huh? Ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to be here. I told someone coming in the door, I feel like I'm coming back home. I love this area. It's so nice to come to Oregon. You guys are so innovative here. The fact that you're holding this meeting this morning, and truly, it was a great idea, whoever decided to do that, to have everyone introduce themselves, because typically you go to a conference this size, and they don't take the time to introduce each other, they don't introduce themselves to each other. So you spend a day trying to learn next to people you really are not sure who they are and where they fall in to what I call this old global child welfare and family welfare system that we are trying to build for our families and children. Judge Waller, thank you so very much for that lovely introduction. My mother always said, when you start believing your own hype, you're really in trouble. But that does sound pretty good, doesn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know me, I prepared remarks for you today. But if you don't mind, I think what I'd like to do is actually come and talk with you from my heart, if that's okay with you. I think this is an issue that deserves an honest conversation. And so if you don't mind, I'd like to do that. Also, because I don't like podiums, I'm going to come down there if that's okay with you as well. All right. What I like to do, since I get the mic, I would like to talk about some of the things that I think we need to really focus on when we talk about our children and our families in need of court intervention and who find themselves in a crisis. What I'd like to do is start off throwing out some ideas, principles first, that I think we all believe in, or we all agree to, at least on some level. And then what I'd like to do is talk about some programs that I think are starting to work on some of these principles, and then challenge you in this next day, or today, to really think about principles that you feel that I have not touched on, but more importantly, principles that your link, if we look at what I call family and child wellness system, the stuff that we all do, whether you're a judge, a lawyer, a researcher, whatever your official responsibilities are, but if we link each one of our systems together, each one of our offices, each one of our responsibilities together, I would suggest that the judiciary may be one link. So I work in that sphere. So if we can start linking all of our expertise together, I think what we would then be able to do is build a foundation for which our children and our families have a chance at wellness. Does that make sense? Ladies and gentlemen, I grew up in a Baptist church, so I have to hear something. Judge, you're crazy. Amen. Okay. I'm thinking about it. anything but something, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. First of all, one of the principles I think that we forget to remember is that my kids experience trauma when we remove them from their homes. Now, that's a novel thought, right? But the reality is we are doing what we know is best for that child at that time, and it probably is. It should be, right? It is. We may be saving that child's life, but nevertheless, it's trauma. So even when our kids have good experiences in child welfare, one placement, and they get adopted, that's still trauma. And we can't forget that. So I would suggest that's an underlying principle that we really have to think about, and we really make certain that we are treating and addressing when we're dealing with my children and my families, okay? Another principle that I think we forget about that you're going to focus on today, which is child development. Now, I don't have any biological children, but I have 6 nieces and nephews. And one of the things I can tell you, when they come to visit me, and they're from the ages of 9 to 14, 15 right now, when the 9-year-old's there, it's vastly different than when the 15-year-old's there. Trust me. And for Aunt Pat, that's a struggle. But I think it's imperative that we remember that we take our children where we get them. We can't make our children a different developmental stage or a different developmental age than where they are. And we have to recognize and make certain that our interventions are appropriate based on their developmental needs. One of the other things that I get tired of hearing about, and you guys are so much better than we are in Cook County. In Cook County, first of all, let me just get this out. In Cook County, my juvenile court's divided in half. I have child protection. I'm the presiding judge of the Child Protection Division, Abuse and Neglect. There's another person who presides over the juvenile justice or the delinquency area. My adoptions are done by a division downtown. My domestic violence is done by another division downtown. My criminal court's done by another division. My traffic court, all of our divisions are broken up. So we're a very segregated judicial system. Segregated city too, but judicial system as well. That's true, though. Seriously. If you tell me that you're from Chicago and you tell me you grew up on the south side of the city, I could generally tell you your heritage. Isn't that ridiculous? But anyway, that's another issue. All right, so I have a segregated judicial system. What that means is that I treat the problem that comes in that door. So even if my parent has a substance abuse problem or a mental health problem, and they're coming in the child abuse door, I treat the child abuse issue. If they have a domestic violence issue, that's not really on the forefront of my agenda. Now, I'm a general court jurisdiction, which means a judge, which means I have the judicial authority to issue an order of protection, the judicial authority to have an enforcement hearing. But because of the way my system is set up, it's vastly discouraged. So if I issue an order of protection, there's no one to follow it up. If I issue an interim order of adoption, there's no one to follow it up in my division, okay? The problem is my families and kids don't come segregated. They don't come and raise their hand and say, Judge Martin, but I have more problems than that, or I have more issues to deal with than that. The thing that's really phenomenal to me is that I'm the Child Protection Division presiding judge, but most of my services are geared toward the parents. Now, that makes sense on one level. If my parents are not doing well, they can't do well for my kids. That makes sense. I believe that to my core. But am I really helping my kids? Am I really getting to the issues that my kids are dealing with? So I would suggest the fact that we're starting to think about our families on a more holistic approach, a holistic forum, a holistic platform that does better not only for my parents, but for my children in the long run. So I would ask us to start looking at domestic violence issues, for instance, not only when you're dealing with a child protection case, the juvenile justice case. I would ask us to start thinking about substance abuse in our child protection cases, our domestic violence cases, our juvenile justice cases. I would start thinking about dual diagnoses. Most of my families, now this is Pat Martin 101, you know, treatment modalities. But most of my families who come in with a substance abuse problem also tend to have a mental health issue. Now, who am I? I don't have any expertise in mental health. All I know is that they're exhibiting signs that the experts tell me I need to be concerned about. So why are we having drug courts and not treatment courts? And I'm not being critical. Cook County's in the process now of developing a treatment court for our families. And I will tell you, if I've had headaches before, I'm having really headaches now. But the issue is really, are we treating the family or are we treating spots and pieces and units? And isn't it better to treat the cancer, not just put a Band-Aid over the cancer? Don't we have better outcomes or potential for better outcomes if we actually get to the root of the issue of our families? Ladies and gentlemen, one of the things that I'm very proud that Cook County is doing now, we've had social work students from the social work schools come into our building and sit down and talk with our lawyers and our judges. We're now having our medical residents rotate in their PEDS rotation. They come into our courts and talk with us about child abuse and neglect. You know, when I first got to be presiding judge, we started bringing in doctors to talk with our judges about some of the typical things the court is seeing and try to give us some baseline knowledge about medical stuff, as I call it. And you grab on, if you're anything like me, you grab onto a catchphrase. So I grabbed onto, for instance, spiral fractures only occur when there's child abuse. And you get stuck on that, and you get stuck in stupid, as my nephew says. That's stuck on stupid, Aunt Pat. And so we all have an obligation to ourselves, but more importantly to our families, to make certain we have a holistic understanding of those elements. So why are we not? Why are we not doing more of what you're doing today, bringing in our researchers, bringing in our docs, bringing in our psychiatrists and psychologists, talking together? You can gather from now that I'm not someone who follows the rules too much. So I had a kid, and I couldn't get the IEP done at the Chicago Public School. Now, first of all, I swear to you, I didn't even know what an IEP was. So I just ordered one. Why they let me order stuff at the CPS, I have no idea, but they let me order it, so I kept ordering until they told me to stop. So I ordered this IEP, and I scheduled it for 8:30 in the morning, so I picked up the, now I lived in a western suburb, I picked the kid up from the south side, took him to Mickey D's, and got to school on the south side in time, waited an hour and a half for the principal. So I was ticked off to begin with, all right? That was not a good, and it was cold out, so I was ticked. By the time they sat down and they realized that I wasn't leaving, they said, well, we're going to cancel it. I said, oh, no, we're not. Not today, we're not canceling it. But during that whole hour and a half meeting, no one could tell me officially from CPS what grade my kid failed. Now, I'm sitting in CPS. I'm not at the courthouse demanding that they give me information about his educational career. I'm sitting in their forum, and they couldn't even tell me what grade he failed. First of all, no one asked me my authority to be there. They didn't ask grandmother if I could be there. They didn't ask the kid if I could be there. And they didn't even ask what authority I had to take out my order form and start issuing orders. So they just let me walk. No one asked for an ID. No one asked for anything. Anyway, so what I learned, though, that morning was that I had no idea how to talk to CPS. I had no idea what the educational system was like. So what we did in an effort to, because I can't learn CPS lingo, I can't learn their language in a day, we got CPS to agree to bring one of their employees and house them in my courthouse. So when I have a problem with CPS, and they have a CPS computer right along with my clerk's computer, my court computer. So when I have a problem about a kid's education, I call Barb Chavarris down in her office, give her the issue, and she comes back to my courtroom within a half hour with some baseline information. All I'm saying is that we're never going to learn the medical lingo. We're never going to learn how to be a social worker if you're not one. We're not going to be able to learn all of that stuff. But we have to figure out ways to work together to make certain that what we're doing, we're getting adequate information, complete information, so that we can make the best decisions that we can with the information that we have for our children and families at the time. So, now let's start talking about some of the things that I think are kind of cool that are happening around the nation. As I indicated earlier, in Cook County, all of our judicial divisions are segregated. One of the things the National Council is promoting is a project called Project One, O-N-E. One stands for one judge, one family. N stands for no matter which courthouse or court door you come into. And E stands for equity of justice or equal access to justice. And the thought is to really make certain that you have all the tools you need to take care of the family's issues in one place. So you don't take care of the child protection issues, then ship them off to get an order of protection in the domestic violence court. You don't ship them off to then take care of the traffic matter that the kid, you know, went joyriding for 2 minutes and got caught on a, you know, in somebody's car or something or whatever it is. The thought is to look at what the family needs and sit down, and I call it a staffing. Now that's, everybody tells me, Judge, that's not the right term, but that's what I call it. Where the representatives from the different divisions that you need sit around and talk about, and I'm not saying don't prosecute. If prosecution's necessary, prosecute. But the issue isn't just the prosecution. The issue is what does the family need? What does the unit need? It kind of looks like MST that went around the nation a while ago on the juvenile justice side, where you really do assess what are the needs and then find the bases or find the services that serve those needs. Some of the other projects that are talked about around the nation, we have a lot of dually involved kids, right? A lot of kids who have child protection cases and also pick up juvenile justice cases. Now, the way I look at the juvenile justice cases, a lot of times those are fake juvenile justice cases, right? The kid is in a state-supported institution. It's after dinner. The kid wants a candy bar, and they say no candy after 5. The kid sneaks in and gets a candy bar, and they get him on trespass of state-supported property. I call that a fake JJ case, but that's what I call it. Prosecutors don't necessarily agree with me, by the way. But the point is, yes, he stole the candy. And I'm not stole it, but he went and bought the candy when he wasn't supposed to have the candy. So there should be some consequences for that. I'm not suggesting a case, but there should be some consequences. I'm not asking him not to get to the point where he understands when he has to comply with authority. That's not what I'm asking. But does it justify a JJ case? If he weren't at the state-supported institution in the beginning, he wouldn't have had a trespass to state-supported land in the beginning. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So we have to be more, we have to be smarter about how we're helping our kids and helping their families. One of the things that we didn't talk about is some of the information that we're learning from our tribal courts. Our friends on the tribal court have a real great expansive information or expansive definition of family. One of the things we have to understand, if we're not blood related, but I consider that my uncle, I consider that my aunt, we have to somehow codify and respect that relationship. So in Cook County, I've changed the permanency laws. Don't tell anyone in Springfield, they haven't caught on yet. But in Cook County, no kid leaves our system without having a caring adult. Now that doesn't mean it has to rise to the level of appropriate placement. That's vastly different. My kids need a placement, they need a permanent home, they need a permanent family. That's a given. But in addition to that, they need what I call an Aunt Kitty. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm on old age pension on the other side. My parents both died probably about 25 years ago. My mom, 25, my dad, 26 years ago. Wow. I'm the oldest of three. So I was the only one out of school. I was a practicing lawyer at the time. My brother was in medical school. My sister was still an undergrad up here in Vermont. Up here. Kind of up there. Anyway, so I had these and my dad had been bedridden. My mother closed his practice like 10 years before her death, and my dad was bedridden. And so I had these responsibilities. And literally, when we were at home, our parents bought us alarm clocks when we were in school. But when we were at home, the way we woke up, my mother would sing Precious Lord down the halls of our house. Now, my mother couldn't sing worth a lick. But as, Luther says something about, if I could just see my dad dance again, if I could hear my mother sing one more time, it would make it all right. But nevertheless, that's how we woke up when we were at home. And as the oldest one in the house, or the one who felt responsible for a family, I literally could not figure out how we were going to get up the next morning. I couldn't see how I was going to wake up, you know, get my dad in his Hoya lift, get my brother up and get him motivated to study, get my sister back to school. I just couldn't figure it out. I didn't have a clue what I was going to do the next morning. Well, my Aunt Catherine, one of my mom's sisters, called me at 6 o'clock that morning. And she called me at 6 o'clock Central Time every morning, that morning until the day she died a year and a half ago. Now, that was 6 Central. So if I was in Australia, that was 6 Central. But the point is, she asked me 3 questions, the same 3 questions every morning. And that was basically, sweetheart, how are you doing? What are you going to do today? And how do you feel? And that was it. So, you know, I kind of got sloppy. Oh, Aunt Kitty, I'm sleeping. What do you think I'm doing? You know, but in hindsight, that was my rock. I mean, if she stopped calling me one morning, I would not know what to do. I mean, that was just so ingrained in my soul. No matter where I was, no matter what challenges I faced, I had that rock always. That was mine. And why is it, if I had an Aunt Catherine calling me, her name's Aunt Kitty, K-I-T-T-Y, but her real name was Catherine, we called her Aunt Kitty. If Aunt Kitty called me every morning at 6, why aren't my kids having an Aunt Kitty call them? Why is there not a rock calling them saying, good morning, sweetheart, how do you feel? Good morning, sweetheart, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. Good morning, sweetheart, what are you going to do today? What's on your schedule today? So no kid in foster care in Cook County leaves without an Aunt Kitty. I suggest all of our kids, juvenile justice or child protection, need an Aunt Kitty. I suggest it's only fair that they have someone they can rely on. Everyone needs someone. Like my kids in foster care, my kids on juvenile justice, all of us need someone. I was going to say, ooh, that was me. The other thing, ladies and gentlemen, that was good. The other thing, ladies and gentlemen, and don't tell any lawyers this, okay? But, you know, I'm kind of tired of lawyers. Lawyers in my court serve a great purpose, and we have a great system set up. So every kid has a lawyer assigned to them. I have a guardian and a lawyer. It may be the same person, but someone has the responsibilities for both of those roles for my kids. Every respondent, every parent has a lawyer. So if they're not married, both the mom and the dad have a lawyer. Even if they're married sometimes. No, seriously, if they're going through and having difficulties, we give them both lawyers so we don't have to deal with that conflict in the end. My department has a lawyer representing them. So everyone's represented, and that I would suggest that has, there's good reasoning behind that, okay? But there are times when we get to be lawyers so much that we forget what we're lawyering for. And so I get motions like, I didn't get the service plan 14 days in advance. I only got it 12 days in advance. That to me is lawyering. That to me is not adequately representing your client or representing your client in the best interest. That's just being a lawyer. And so, and I'm a lawyer by trade, so I don't want anyone to walk out of here and say Judge Martin hates lawyers. So that's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is let's be smart about our lawyering. So what would it look like, for instance? Where's Mary, by the way? Yeah, okay. She's keeping me on time. I start thinking, man, I start talking a little bit here. Okay. What would it look like if we had a mediation division? The lawyers represent the parties, but the focus of the mediation is really the experts, the psychologists, the social workers, the doctors who give us their expertise about what the family needs and how they can address the ills that the family has. The court is there to codify what they say. So if they say mom needs individual counseling, I can issue an order to demand that mom goes to individual counseling. And the lawyers are there to make certain that the rights of the party are protected in that petition. But the real focus, the real drive, the real ingenuity, the real work that we're doing is following the recommendations of the experts. So the focus isn't emotion that I didn't get the service plan on time. The focus is whether or not we have the bilingual parenting classes that we need. By the way, how do you give someone parenting classes without the kid there? No, seriously, do you have that? Parenting classes and the parents go, but the kid doesn't go? How do you learn how to parent if you don't have a kid to parent? No, I... Okay, don't laugh, but I still think that's crazy. But anyway, back to my mediation model. What do you think about the fact that we would actually focus on the problems as opposed to focusing on who's the first chair in the office in that courtroom? Who's the one that makes the motions to get the court all fouled up or get the workers all fouled up? Who's the one that's in there trying to trap the cop into telling us that they didn't really see the kid drop the dope? I mean, that, don't get me wrong, that's important. That's important evidence. I appreciate that. But is that what's really driving and really directing the treatment for my family? I would suggest that's something we need to think about. I would suggest we need to think about whether or not a courtroom is the best forum to have the dynamics of a family. Families don't look at defense and prosecution. Families aren't divided into two. There are different rights and there are different wrongs within a family structure. We have to learn about the family structure if we're going to be more successful in making certain that our families stay whole. What if we thought about court, juvenile court, like an emergency triage unit? Right? So an emergency room, you go in because you have a problem. You get assessed right in the ER room. If they think the problem is sufficient that you have to come into the hospital, you get admitted in and taken care of for those few days. You get a discharge order that tells you what to do for follow-up. So what would happen if we had a family that had a problem, that came into court no matter what the problem was, whether it was a substance abuse problem that precluded them from adequately caring for their kids, whether it's a domestic violence problem that precluded them from adequately providing supervision for their kids. We assessed it as to whether or not the family could stay together as a unit or whether or not we had to bring the kids out or whether or not we got the perp out of the house and left the kids with the mom or the non-perping, non-offending adult. Sent them home and treated the perp sufficiently to put him or her back with the family unit and leave them with follow-up services for community-based service providers. I wonder what would that look like? Would we be raising kids in foster care if we did something like that? I wonder what we'd be saddling our kids with criminal convictions if our court system looked something more along those lines. What's really hurtful, I was in D.C. last week. They brought a young man from downstate Illinois. He had been working through the Balance and Restorative Justice and Models for Change, doing phenomenally well. The kid was arrested for armed robbery. It was reduced down to a robbery, but it's a felony. He couldn't get a pass to the White House. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about you, but that seems a little backwards to me. That seems just a tad bit backwards to me. That we have a kid who has been striving, who's been working, who's doing phenomenally well to the point that he was on house arrest and we got the court to agree to allow him to come to share his story with providers. And then we won't let him get inspired by going to the White House? Come on. We have to be smarter about what we're doing for our kids and our families. If we really do our job well, when we leave the family, they will look better and be in a better position than when we met them. So we shouldn't be leaving them with convictions. Why haven't we thought about automatic expungements for some of our kids? I don't know about you, but in Illinois, they've reduced possession, simple possession, from a misdemeanor offense down to a city ordinance. If you can only get fined, why are you still giving my kids supervision, probation? And at least if you're going to do that, give it to them with an automatic expungement. Do you know how many kids in child protection can't get a job because they have a conviction, they have a probation? Let's be a little smarter about our kids and families. Now, I'm not advocating marijuana, but I am saying if we're reducing them down to an ordinance, why are my kids the ones who are still being penalized? That's not fair. I never ask for a handout for my kids, but I ask them to have equal access to a fair foundation, a good foundation, so they can be in a position to make better decisions for themselves and for their families. All right, let's talk about some things for my kids. I started off by saying that my kids are in child protection, but most of the services are focused on the adults. There's good reason for that. I'm not saying that that's a problem. But what would it look like if we had an MST-like, does everybody know what MST is? Multisystemic treatment, basically? Basically what it is, on the juvenile justice side, from my understanding, there is a program that basically assesses the family, and they have a multidiscipline assessment. So they have psychologists, they have medical doctors, they have educational experts, all going into the home. They don't bring the family out of the home. You go in to their particular situation, you assess the family, what their needs are. So why couldn't we have something like that that focuses on the parents' needs and something like that that focused on the kids' needs at one time? I mean, why would you come to child protection and deal with the parents and leave the kids with their own issues? And then go to the JJ side, deal with the older kids, but leave the younger kids? Wouldn't that allow us an opportunity to not only look at the protective factors and the risk factors together? Wouldn't that give us a better chance to be predictive about the SIBs, the younger SIBs? Wouldn't that give us an opportunity maybe to talk about prevention in a real sense for some of the kids in that household? I personally don't understand why we don't have home nursing, visiting nurses anymore. Now, in Cook County, I understand it because we're crazy. You know, we have one bad case, so you can no longer talk about family preservation. Has anyone heard of the Wallace case? We had a judge a few years ago that took a mother who had some severe mental health issues. She was maintained under medication for quite some time. We sent her home with her kid, and she hung her kid in the closet like within a week of returning home. That was a horrible case, and I'm not minimizing it or trying to minimize it. But that happened before I got on the bench. I've been the presiding judge since January 2000, and we still can't talk about family preservation. Come on. You know what I mean? We have this ability, once we have a bad case, we swing the pendulum all the way to the other side, and it literally takes a generation for us to start swinging it back. Let's get smarter about our children and our families. Let's get smarter about understanding what they need and addressing their needs as opposed to what we feel they should need. Let's get smarter when our legislator says we actually have to include kids in their permanency. This is no joke. In Cook County, I just happened to be in this courtroom on this day. The issue was a motion to violate the mother's order of supervision. She was getting unsupervised visits. And the basis of the violation petition was because she hit the kid, and the kid suffered some physical harm, a cut, I think it was. The lawyers were all arguing at the bench. There was a kid running around in the back of the courtroom to the point that he was disrupting, and everybody told him to be quiet. And they were arguing about the extent of the injury. No one turned around and said, little Joe, come here so I can see the cut. No one turned around and said, let's find out how severe the child was injured. So we get to the point where we're talking so much about what we think is best when we don't even look at what's sitting in our face and right before us. When we talk about including families and talking about kids, let's bring them to the table. Have them actually give us information. Listen, these parents took care of their kids long before we met them. And the reality is they're going to have their kids after we leave. Let's find out what they think they need to help their families. Why do I continue to take a kid from my mother and then give the kid to someone this child has no clue about, pay her to take care of the kid, when half the mom's problem is she can't get out of the project where she has to go past her drug dealer to get to the grocery store? Ladies and gentlemen, let's be smarter about our families. When the treatment centers tell me that it's best to treat my mom with her toddler at the center, and I don't have enough beds, let's get smarter where we put our service dollars. Let's get smarter about what we need and what we demand, particularly when our budgets are shrinking. We have to deal with what we have. That is a reality. We are not going back to the 90s where we were flush. That's not going to happen anytime soon. Let's get smarter about working together, figuring out what we need, and figuring out how we can get that in place. Let's talk about my little kids. One of the things when I started as the presiding judge in Cook County, I'm sorry, I'm standing right in front of you. I didn't even realize that. Most of my kids coming into care at that time were very young toddlers. You know, the 2 and 3 year old cute little cuddly kids that everybody wanted to adopt. Soon it became apparent that my kids were growing up in foster care and the bulk of my population now shift to older youth. We've been barking about the fact that we haven't been able to pay attention to our older youth. Why are we not having hearings centralized just on older youth? Why aren't we having service-based, community-based services based on the evidence and the information we know that works for older youth? Why are we not having more court calls that we deal with just the medication that everyone's telling us our kids need? I would suggest to you, let's start looking at our problems and focusing on what our problems are and making certain that we're not doing what makes us feel good, but make certain we're doing what gives our families and our kids an opportunity and a foundation to really have a chance at life. There are a multitude of studies and literature out there talking about the fact that when kids have child protection cases, when they come to the attention of child protection services, they have a more predictive tendencies to go into juvenile justice. I don't deny that. I don't deny that when you have crisis in your home, you have to figure out how to deal with the crisis. How many of you, when you were in elementary school, had to take a civics class? I did. My civics class taught me about the three branches of government, taught me about the independence of all three branches. The civics class taught me, made certain I knew the Pledge of Allegiance and all this. I don't even know what's in the civics class anymore. But it was basic elementary stuff. It wasn't a grade that was administered, but it was a pass-fail, and it didn't contribute to my GPA or whatever. Why are we not talking about core courses of alternatives to violence for our kids based on a civics model? Why are my kids in detention there on the average of 12 days? Why are you trying to give them a whole class on governmental affairs or math lessons? Why aren't you giving them a civics class-like class based on nonviolence? We talk about the violence my kids experience. We talk about the fact that they don't have alternatives for violence. Why aren't we developing curriculum that talks and teaches them? And why aren't we demanding that everyone pass that class before they graduate? If nothing else, we're helping them to feel their feelings, but in a way that is conducive to our society and our societal norms. Why aren't we giving them tools that help them once they get outside the door of that detention facility? We talk about violence. Let's find ways to give them tools to deal with the hurt that they have. The other thing that our Native American tribal courts are teaching us and helping us to understand, not only this expansive definition of family, but the issue of adoption. All the states require a termination or a termination of parental rights in order to have an adoption. My understanding is that most tribal courts and tribal communities do not require a termination. They look at an adoption as adding on, increasing the family, increasing opportunities for helping to parent this child. Now, what we've done in Illinois along that line is we still require a termination for our adoption. But now we're looking at, and we have a sunshine legislation in place right now that allows us to reverse the termination. So some of my legal orphans, the kids that I terminated the rights when the kid was three, the kid is not in a pre-adoptive home, the kid is generally in a residential facility. Now the kid's 17, 18, we keep cases open until 21. That would be great if we did something creative and helpful, but just keeping them open to 21 doesn't magically make it better. But now my kid's 16, 17, 18. And when he runs from the home, he's going to his mom's house. As my cousin, as my nephew says, I'm Pat, that's stuck on stupid. Why are we not trying to figure out a way to help strengthen that relationship? Now, mom might still be a drunk. And that's her thing. But why aren't we teaching my kid how to navigate mom? I don't know about you, but in my family, when I went down to the family reunion on my mother's side, they're still doing moonshine. And going down there, my mother would say, Pat, now don't stay by Uncle JoJo and Uncle da-da-da-da, you know. So my parents were teaching me how to navigate my family. Why aren't we doing that for our kids in foster care? Why aren't we helping them to understand the good aspects of mom, but making certain he understands to leave those other aspects? Now, I don't mind helping mom, and I want to help mom try to get off drugs. And that's great. But the point is, and what my focus would be, on helping the child navigate his family. Doesn't that give him a better opportunity at success in the future? So we are starting to essentially reverse our TPRs. And now this I take great pride in. Because before we started getting that law in effect, I was just basically giving the biological mom that I terminated it when the kid was 3, I was giving her a legal guardianship of the kid at 17. So they were like, Judge, you can't do that. And I said, no one showed me in the book I can't do that. So this is another way to just make certain that we do what we know is best for our kids. Yeah, legally it was gymnastics, if you will. But finally Springfield caught on. Pretty soon they're going to catch on about the Aunt Kitty rule, too. I betcha. But ladies and gentlemen, all I'm talking about is the stuff that we've been talking about for years. All I'm suggesting and all I'm asking you to do is think about how we can be more creative and really sit down and think about what our families and our kids need. And first of all, talk about our kids within the family unit. If we know that the state is a poor parent, then it's our obligation to make certain our kids have the benefit of a family unit. And if we fail there, then we really truly have failed all of our children. I think you're right on talking about safety. I think you're right on talking about preventive measures. I think you're right on in bringing different disciplines together to look at these issues. These are not singular issues. You know, when I got on the bench and I started to have families telling me, Judge, I don't need to go to therapy and I don't need to have medication, I used to say, I'll take the family homemaker. They can come and teach me how to clean my house. I'll take the couch. By the time I'm at work a day, I need a couch. But I think we really need to start talking about how we can better improve the lives of our children. I have one other point that I'd really like to talk with you about this morning, and then I really will leave you guys alone. I can already tell I'm starting to blow everybody away saying, gosh, she's a judge and she doesn't follow the rules very well, does she? But ladies and gentlemen, have you ever seen a kid come into your courtroom? Notice, how many of you have children at home under the age of 18 or nieces or nephews or grandkids under the age of 18? Okay, we're in the holiday season. During the holiday season, at some point, just sit down and listen to the commotion that goes on between your nieces, nephews, grandkids, and younger children. And look at their eyes. The one thing I think you will notice is that there's a vast difference between the sparkle in their eyes and the eyes that you see of the kids who stand before my bench day in and day out. There's a complete affect. There's a complete blank. There is a complete lack of hope in my children. And think about where you got your hope. Where did you get your self-esteem? Where did you get this ability to think you could do? I don't know about you, but in my house, my mom cooked every day. And my mom owned a dry cleaners. But every single solitary day, my mom made dinner, and we sat around the dinner table. The TV was not going. The radio was not on. It was family conversation. And that's where I learned how to balance a checkbook. That's where I learned when things don't go well, how to pick myself up. That's where I learned that if all I got was an A in gym, that was good. So long as I tried my best, I would be okay. That I always had to try my best. Where are my kids learning those things? I don't know, but I would suggest to you my kids need those lessons too. Now I'm going to tell you something that no one likes me talking about, but since we're all family, I'm sure you don't mind. I believe that if my kids cannot stay at home, my job is to find them a loving family. And I tell people all the time, I don't care if that family's red, yellow, green, or orange with yellow polka dots. I really don't care. So long as they have the capacity to love my child, and love my child enough to try to help them go to their biological families when it's appropriate. But if not appropriate, love them enough to keep them and make them a part of their family. And it doesn't matter to me if you're Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, Islam. It doesn't matter to me, so long as you can love my child. Now, people criticize me on that. And they say, Judge, we need to put black kids with black kids, Indian kids with Indian kids, and all this kind of stuff. Now, I have a preference. And I think there are cultural issues that we have to be aware of. And where this comes in, if you are a black man in our society, the bottom line is you have to learn how to conduct yourself in white America. Now, we can talk about race and we cannot talk about race, but this is the reality of it. When I grew up, my mom constantly said, when you go in a store, do not touch, because people will start following you. When I take my little nephews into stores with me, I make them hold my hands. And the reason is, I will be in Cook County Jail if someone comes over and accuses my nephews of doing something or comes in on my nephews. So it's easier for me to teach them how to protect themselves than for me to go to Cook County Jail. But my families need to learn how to teach my kids these things as well. The reality in white America is the darker the skin of my child, the more that child has to understand how to protect themselves. If I'm offending anyone, I apologize, and we can talk later. But the reality is when something happens to me each and every day from the time I woke up this morning till the time I go to bed, when something is said by me, I have to quickly ascertain if it's sexist, racist, if it is one of those things, what position am I in? Am I here as the presiding judge? Am I here as the president of the National Council? Or am I here as Kathy and Billy's sister? And what is my response? Or do I respond? In every situation, there it calls for a different response. And so you say to me, Pat, why do you always have to put color in it? Because color is there. Color is there. Race is there. My sister's married to a white gentleman. My brother's married to a white woman. So all my nieces and nephews, all six of them, are mixed. Now, you can tell from my personality, when I go there, I talk about the United Nations, and everybody laughs except for my sister. She kind of is like, Pat, shut up. But the reason is, I talk about this, is because my nieces and nephews need to understand. When I go down Michigan Avenue with my nieces and nephews, people think I'm the maid. And that's fine. I don't care. It really, honestly, doesn't bother me. But what bothers me is when they do it in front of my nieces and nephews. It bothers me when I'm the presiding judge of one of the largest units in Cook County, and people treat me like I should be sweeping the floor in front of my nieces. Now, if they did it to me by myself, I could care less. Half the time, I joke about it and keep walking. I go into Target, and I have black slacks on, and they ask me, do I work here? Target's colors are tan and red, folks. But when I'm by myself, honestly, even on a bad day, that doesn't bother me. But it really hurts me when I'm with my nieces and nephews. It bothers me when they ask me, Aunt Pat, why do they treat you that way? And so it's important for me, because I love them, to make certain they understand that. And it's not about racism at all. I mean, their father's black, white, and their mother's white. So it's not about racism. It's about making certain they understand how to conduct themselves. So again, I go back to this premise. I don't care if my kids grow up in a house where the parents are red with yellow polka dots. It really doesn't bother me. But they have to appreciate the culture from which my child comes from. And if they themselves are not going to develop an environment where my kids understand about their culture, then they have to at least be willing to give them that outlet. At least be willing. So when we talk about ICWA, I keep trying to find out why we don't have BICWA. The point of the matter is, though, ICWA is great for our Native American children. But the reality is, why don't we have that standard for all of our kids? Why aren't we talking about actual efforts for all of our kids? Are black kids or white kids less important than Native American kids? And don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to do away with ICWA. I think that's the best thing we've done in child welfare for a long time. But if it's necessary for kids of the Native American culture, why isn't it necessary for other cultures that our kids come from? Why isn't it necessary for black boys who want to wear big afros to understand how society views them? Not how they are. That doesn't mean that they're militant. That doesn't mean that they're going to shout black power or whatever happens these days. But what that means is that they're going to be viewed a certain way when they walk out of their house. And why aren't we teaching them what that means? Why aren't we making certain they understand that? And not to the extent we're teaching them that white people are bad, because that's not the case. That has nothing to do with it. What it has to do with is their perceptions of themselves and how they are going to be perceived in our society and how they can protect themselves better in our society. We all have these biases, ladies and gentlemen. You have them and I have them. You know, when I finish work on a Friday night and I'm ready to get some barbecue and I go to the South Side and I have on a suit and heels and someone looks at me, yeah, I cross the street too. But the issue is, what do we do with these biases? And I would suggest to you that we need to recognize we all have these biases and put them on the back shelf so we can make decisions that are best for our children and families. But don't forget, we need to teach my kids what some of these biases are too. We need to make certain that we help them develop the tools to deal with them as well. We're trying to figure out ways to give them foundational tools so they have a fair chance at becoming productive members of our society. That's our job, no matter what capacity we are fulfilling that job in. My last thing, I said that 2 times ago, didn't I? Sorry about that. My very last thing, ladies and gentlemen, is I am very proud of the work that you're doing. It is remarkable that 12, 14 years ago, we didn't sit in the room with researchers, we didn't sit in the room with docs, we didn't sit in the room with psychiatrists to really understand what's happening with our kids. That is coming more commonplace for all of us. And I would suggest that we need to do more of that. We need to do more of just sitting next to them, but making certain we understand their work and they understand our work. I have a lot of researchers that come in and give me information, and they always give me the PAT file. So they give me all these graphs with all these pretty colors on them. I can't understand that stuff. Honest to God, I've tried really, really hard. But I can't understand that stuff. So then they give me the PAT file with the narrative that says, Judge Martin, when it goes up, it means no. But the point is, if we're not going to understand each other's language, we have to understand the information. That's the imperative part. And you have done a remarkable job of laying the foundation and giving yourselves the opportunity to learn from each other. Please take advantage of that today and in the future. Make certain that you know who the people are that are doing the research and what research they're doing. And what I do is I give my researchers issues. So I tell them, I see this trend. They're tearing down the projects in Chicago and all my families are scattering. My caseloads are shifting. You need to tell me what you can predict about this. Now that's not in research language. They take that away and put research language and give me studies and then come up and give me answers. But that's working together, using the information we have together, and I would suggest that you use the information that you have available to you as well. I am delighted to be here. Thank you so very much for the opportunity and the privilege to come and learn with you today.